83,000 horses and burros roam wild and free throughout the empty spaces of the great American West. Though some very serious voices say they should not be allowed to run free, other serious voices say, let them run. And so today we ask, should we let the wild horses run free?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1365th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Buenos Aires who are tuned into the podcast as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, out here in the great American West, there are still a lot of wide open spaces. But as Aristotle once said, nature abhors a vacuum. And so did the horses and burros that moved right into those wide open spaces, giving them life. Horses and burros were brought to the West by Spanish conquistadors, from which they made their escape into the void, where they became wild and free animals. Over the course of time, the animals that preyed on those wild horses and domestic livestock were, for the most, wiped out, leaving the horses to roam freer than ever before. Today, an estimated 83,000 wild horses and burros roam free in what's left of the wide open spaces of the American West, but they are not really free. In 1971, Congress passed the Wild Free Roaming Horses and Burros Act, and now the wild and free are wards of the state. The Bureau of Land Management is required by this law to manage wild horses and burro populations so as to maintain a healthy balance with the environment. It is the management of these populations of wild horses and burros that we find our story. And who better to tell that story than country western music recording star Lacey J. Dalton, who is also the president of Let 'Em Run Foundation. Lacey J., welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you so much, Michael. It's my pleasure to be here. And I have to say, at this age, it's nice to be anywhere at all.
How many miles have you put in singing your songs?
Well, I have to say, somebody asked me, in fact, I think it was my manager who asked me the other day. She said, why do you hate flying? I said, because when I was 46 years old, I had a million miles on one of the four airlines that I was using at the time. I'm just over it. And it used to be a lot more luxurious. As you remember, you could actually move in your seat at one time, and they brought you food. And actually, if you sat in business class or first class, the food was actually really good. They didn't give you these foul little salty, they're not even really pretzels, are they? I don't know what those things are.
And who knows what they're made out of, too. So it's a great big mystery.
I had this wonderful mother, but she said, you know, she said, I think you probably will, die on an airplane. And I said, thanks, Ma. That's a really good thing to put in my head. Yeah. I don't know why in the world she told me that. I have it all planned, though, Michael. If the plane starts to go down, I'm going to stand up, and I'm going to sing Amazing Grace. All the way down.
And it's a good song to sing all the way down. Maybe we can all practice that one. Sing it together. Who knows? Lacey J., a long distinguished career as a country western recording artist and performer. But what does that have to do with horses? And then I got to thinking, there must be a law that if you sing and perform about country western music, you must have a relationship with horses. It just must be. Is that true?
Well, I think in a way, Michael, that we all have a relationship with horses, whether we know it or not. We have built our civilization on the bones of these animals. And I feel that today we are not respecting the fact that we have built our civilizations on the bones of these animals. They have served us for thousands and thousands of years. Willingly, they have died for us in battle. They have bled for us. They have pulled our wagons. We would never have developed the West had it not been for the horses. So we owe them a debt of gratitude And I am very much opposed to the slaughtering and eating of wild of any horses. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, and you know, in the Bible, I think the Christian people say that Christ will come back on a white horse, so you know he likes it.
There you go. So if he's coming back on a white horse, you better be careful about how you treat horses.
Well,
but is there something connected between country Western folk and the horses that that ties you together in a different sort of way than the rest of us, those people who listen to opera and hip hop and whatnot? I mean, do they love horses like country Western people love horses?
Some of them do.
There you go.
Snoop Dogg helped me. I called Willie Nelson one time when they were trying to close off all the water holes up here to the wild horses. And I said, Willie, can you please, I've written a PSA, can you please do it for me? And Willie said, geez, Lacey, he said, I'm in the studio right now. I leave first thing in the morning to go to Amsterdam. I don't think I have time, but I'll put yours out. And I said, Willie, it wouldn't be the same. I said, people need to hear your voice. Just do this. I said, I really appreciate it, but I so wish there were a way. Well, he went to Amsterdam and he met Snoop Dogg there. And Snoop Dogg and Willie did the PSA, and they stopped that awful thing from happening.
Wow.
So that, you know, so there are a lot of, you know, there are a lot of people from all walks of life who love the wild horses. But in fact, much country music, a lot of country music and Western music, it has been sung by people involved with ranching and rodeoing and farming and people close to the earth. When you are close to the earth, you realize, many people realize a bond between all that is, between the horses and the land and the trees and the water and the sky. There is a, I believe, a spirit that pervades all things, that is in everything. The same spirit that is in you is in that guy looking at you and his dog looking up at him and all. I believe that. I believe that spirit is conscious. And I believe that when we connect with that, and the horse is a very, very connected with spirit. In fact, right now, the U.S. government is paying for programs where there's horse-assisted therapy for the soldiers mm-hmm. coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan with post-traumatic stress syndrome and traumatic head injury. And it is miraculous what working with these animals. You know, the Indians used to say the horses will take our burdens, they'll carry our burdens. And I thought what that my Indian friends were talking about was, you know, that they carried, you know, teepee poles and pots and pans from one place to another. That is not what they meant. And it took me years to understand it. What they meant is the horse has a way, and it is like magic. We do not understand it. I'm sure there's a scientific reason for it. But horses can somehow absorb the emotional negativity from people. People who have been traumatized, autistic children, may say their first words after riding on a horse. There's something that happens. We don't understand it, but we do know that it works.
Well, and with respect to that, Lacey, when you come home from a tour, having flown a bunch of miles and eaten a lot of terrible food and whatnot,
how do you know this?
All of those things that we all end up doing when we're traveling, especially for business, you come home to wild horses. They're right outside.
I do.
You're living among them. Tell us about what you see when you come home to those wild horses.
Well, in the old days, and now you know that William Strickland, who is a famous Santa Cruz, he is the voice, he does all the hog calls.
And he does the ins and outs of this food chain radio program, too. So when the show is reintroduced, that's Will's voice that you'll hear.
He is one of the most recognizable and knowable voices in Santa Cruz, a great entertainer and my friend for many, many, many years, over 50, I'm sure. But he and his wife live here, Shirley, and they love the fact that little bands of wild horses in the old days, 30 or 40, would walk through my across my land every day up here. I live high in the mountains above Reno, only about 24 minutes from the Reno airport because I have to fly in and out. But about, oh, maybe 8 minutes down the road from the old town of Virginia City, which is just like it was 150 years ago. Not been gentrified. It's not, you know, it's just really authentic still. Wooden sidewalks, and I love the town. And it's a wonderful place to visit. There used to be, in the old days, 30 or 40 horses walk across my lawn, across my land. I have about 10 acres up here. And it's not fenced, so the horses come here and they graze and they be in the yard. And Will and Shirley just loves them. You know, she will run out and just sit there and walk. The Will and Shirley love them. Then they and I love them, and it's the reason that I moved up here. And the other reason was that I had to go to Nashville for my record career. My producer at that time insisted on it, so I traveled all the way out there with four horses and five dogs, and got a beautiful farm out there and stayed there for eight of the longest years of my life, and got so homesick for the West, I thought I would die. I thought, I can't be here. This is not where I belong. And I was born in northeastern Pennsylvania, but I didn't feel, I was very beautiful there where I was born, in an agricultural area, a lot of Amish people around, you know, farming organically and doing the right mm-hmm. things for the land. And I did love that, but I didn't belong there. When I came west, the minute I came and crossed the border from Nevada into California during a terrible, terrible snowstorm when I was turning 21, the sun came out and the trees, these beautiful trees, were at state line up at Tahoe. When the minute we hit state line, the sun bursts out of the sky like a million promises, and I knew that I always knew I had to go to California. I always knew I had to come west. I didn't want to as a kid because all I knew of California were these horrible Elvis and Annette Funicello beach movies.
Yeah.
I thought it was like one Orange Julius stand from one end to the other. I had no idea how beautiful Northern California was. Uh-huh. And when I crossed that border at that time, then I knew you're home. And
there you belong. Well, with that, Lacey, let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about what are we going to do with these wild horses? Oh, my goodness. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson with Lacey J. Dalton. We're so lucky to have such a beautiful voice join us today to talk about the things that she loves most. So please do stay tuned. We will be right back.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
You know, I had originally wanted to go up there and do this show with you in person, get some country back in me. I'm from Billings, Montana.
Oh, how did you ever leave? It's so wonderful up there. I just, Bozeman and Billings, I'll be out there in September, and I always look forward. I go every year.
September is the time of year to go there. Now, when you're working on a survey crew in Montana in February, and somebody comes along and gives you a free ticket to this wonderful South Pacific paradise, that's how you end up in the Navy.
Up there in the winter, I would be the same. I'd do the same thing. By the way, congratulations on the Ag News Show of the Year. I have always been very interested in agriculture. In my high school, they would not let me take ag because I was a girl. And I've always been interested in organic gardening, and I love the earth, and I love the trees.
Yeah.
I love the planet. And that's just innate.
Well, you know, I wrote a book called Metro Farm, which is about farming small parcels of land close to the city for the city. And half of the people that I based my book on were women, because women are the traditional metropolitan farmers. In fact, women grow most of the food in the world. Not so much.
I had no idea.
Oh, yeah. It's very significant. And most of the world does not get their food from 1,200 miles away. Most of the world's food comes from close at hand. And most of that food is at the hands of women. Huge percentage of it is.
It's more important than anything you said to me. Anything I've heard for a little while. That is really important.
Well, I got this from a guy named Jacques Schmidt, who was with United Nations Food Development Program. And we hit it off very well because we were both working with space-intensive agriculture. He throughout the world and me here, but he's the one that really saw that firsthand all over the world. But once I started seeing it, looking at it in that respect, I saw it as well. So that's an interesting conversation. I think I'll do a show about that.
Oh, I think you should. I think it's so important. And I think what's really important, I worked in the criminal justice system. I taught at a level 4, 20 to life prison for 3.5 years. Jack Bowers got me the job. Do you know Jack?
Jack who?
Jack Bowers.
Jack Bowers.
Santa Cruz, a musician, wonderful, did the program for the inmates for 30 years at Soledad. Oh,
interesting.
Hot music. Incredible. But what I have wondered is why in all of our prisons we do not have French intensive gardening beds within those prisons for those guys to grow. They don't need tools. They don't need anything.
No.
All they need to do is grow.
I can tell you why we don't.
So good.
Well, I did a radio show from the Soledad Prison Horticulture Program. And as we were on the prison grounds, you could tell that there were two kinds of prisoners. Those who worked in the horticultural program with their hands in the soil, and those who worked out on the metal exercise equipment. You could see the difference in their eyes in a second. And so that they weren't growing any food. I said, my goodness, why aren't they growing food? Think of how you could change the prison diet with the willing hands of people in the HORT program. And he said, oh gosh, if we had food like that, people would kill each other for it.
And that's wouldn't have to if they had plenty.
If they had plenty.
I think that's tin-headed. I'm sorry. I don't believe that at all. I don't believe that at all. I think the more people that you got to have their hands in the soil and watch things grow, the more healing it would be.
Yeah.
And I believe that with all my heart and soul.
Yeah. You and I both.
If you ever knew, Michael, what the music and arts program did. I wasn't a believer, and I went in because of Jack forcing me really to do it. And I've never had a better job in my life, and that's a whole other conversation. But I wish that we had somebody pushing the notion to do intensive gardening in boxes, you know, in containers.
Sure, sure.
You know, so that the soil could be brought in and so on and so forth. And they don't need tools. You don't have to have tools for that kind of gardening.
Yep, your fingers. And maybe check out a trowel once in a while, yeah. Okay, let's go back to horses.
Back to where we are.
Okay, let's see.
From the corners of the country, from the cities and the farms, with years and years of living tucked up underneath their arms, they walk away from everything just to see a dream come true. So God bless the boys who make the noise on 16th Avenue. With a $1 million spirit and an old flat top guitar, they drive to town with Foley on in a...
Well, I think I could listen to that for about 3 hours and not get tired of it. That, ladies and gentlemen, is Lacey J. Dalton and the boys of 16th Avenue. What is the 16th Avenue of which you sing, Lacey?
Well, what 16th Avenue was a quiet street in Nashville, where along which a lot of old brownstones and beautiful homes had been turned into studios and publishing houses where people could go and show their music and either get a writing deal or get turned down and go back to Ohio with their pockets empty, or get signed to a record company. Some of the big record companies and studios then sprung up there. And it was just sort of a town within a town. It was back then Nashville, when I was there, back in 1979, when I was signed to CBS Records, it was a small town within a bigger metropolis. It is now, 16th Avenue no longer exists. It is called Music Square West. And all the publishing houses and stuff, they've been turned into condos and stuff. It's not there anymore.
It's not.
At least not most of it isn't there anymore. But it's still, I found that I was really touched because that song, we went, my partner Dale Panay and I went back a couple Octobers ago to celebrate the 40th anniversary of that song, which I had no idea that many years has passed because I have no idea about time. If time is in the past, like I think 9/11 was about 10 years ago. Of course it wasn't. And, you know, it's like Jell-O in my mind. In the past is like Jell-O. And I don't spend a lot of time there. But I found out after we'd made that performance that still to this day, that song became an anthem for songwriters and people and hopefully, you know, hopeful songwriters coming to Nashville to try to get their music heard and get music played and become stars. And it became an anthem for the songwriters, and the Nashville Songwriters Association still to this day opens their meetings with my version of that song.
Wow.
Which is really, I mean, that's really a nice thing. It's especially since I sounded, I think, like I sang through my nose through the whole song.
You know, I actually know one of those boys from 16th Avenue. He was a Greek immigrant who lived right next door to me as we were growing up in Billings, Montana. His name was Costas Lazardius.
Oh, I know Costas. Well, he's still here.
Yes,
we still have Costas.
Yes, we still have Costas. But he went to Nashville, and he was one of those boys on 16th Avenue that did good. And
very, very well.
Yeah. So, boy, horses and music people, and I think this conversation could go on forever. So let's get back to horses, because you were describing coming home from touring, and you live in a place high above Reno, Nevada, up in the foothills there of the Sierras, and there are horses there. Why are there wild horses there?
Well,
What is it about the place that allows for that?
Actually, I may have described where I live incorrectly. Reno, Nevada sits down in a deep valley called the Truckee Meadows. And on the western side are the Sierra Nevada Mountains, big, wonderful, beautiful Sierras. And on the eastern side, to the east, is a smaller range of mountains called the Virginia Range Mountains. And in those mountains, what is arguably the largest herd of free-roaming wild horses lives on private lands up here near the old town of Virginia City, where I have a small ranch.
And if they live on private land, not on public land.
They live, it's funny, it's checkerboard up here. So, mm-hmm. And it's very odd what happened. In the 40s, the Bureau of Land Management, which I will now refer to as a BLM, but it's the Bureau of Land Management, which I just want to say, according to the Government Accountability Office, is the most untogether organization in all the government, which has to say something, okay? And I've had my good times with those guys and my bad times. It's a tremendous sloppy bureaucracy. But they have, in 1971, they were given control of all the wild free-roaming horses in the United States. However, they determined that up here in the Virginia Range, there were no wild horses. Well, wild horses migrate. When they were checking, the horses were not here. They had migrated, and they migrate hundreds of miles. They don't just stay in one place, but they do stay up here quite a bit of the time, and there are usually 2,500 to 3,000 of them up on this mountain near Virginia City and above Washoe Lake in Carson City. There's a huge mound called Jumbo Grade. It's covered with grass, and the horses are up there. They don't get up into the Sierras as much as you might think. They stay more over on this eastern part of this smaller mountain range, and I believe because there's more grass over here. Mm-hmm. The Sierra is heavily wooded, and it's a lot of forest on that side, so not as much grass for them to eat. And I think that's why they stay on this side. I'm not a biologist, so I don't know that for sure. That's just, you know, observation. But I tell you, people come from all over the world, and I live on the narrow two-lane switchback road that comes from South Virginia Street in Reno all the way up to Virginia City, and it's about a half an hour trip. And about halfway up that road is what we call 5 mile flats. Some people call them 7 mile flats, but it's a big flat area, and it's the only straight place on this switchback road, which was built for the railroad, which brought the timbers from the Sierra all the way up to the Virginia, the top of the Virginia Range Mountains, to the mines. They were the timbers that they used to support the mines in Virginia City. And what I wanted to say is you can see these tour buses that people from all over the world, they're driving on this only straight stretch of this road. And they usually are going about, by that time, it's only a 45 mile an hour road, but they get up to 60 or 75. Suddenly they screech to a halt, pull over to the side, stop. The tourists pour out of the buses and take pictures of the wild horses that tend to be there in the early morning and late in the afternoon. And this is what gives me the notion that there is a win-win way to preserve our wild horses. There are 26,000 of our formerly wild horses now in long-term holding at the taxpayer's expense. There are about 33,000 wild horses left out all of the United States. Most of them, over half of them here in Nevada. And there are, comparatively, 300-some million deer, 33,000 horses, 33 million deer, 1,100,000 antelope, and 4 million elk. So there are only 33,000 wild horses left, and the Bureau of Land Management, that well-organized group, has decided to remove 26,000 of those horses over the next few years, which would leave only 7,000 wild free-roaming horses in all of the United States. This is practically extermination. Yeah. It is an abomination, And in 1979, the American people made their will perfectly clear in the 1971 Wild and Horses Burros Protection Act, which got more letters to Congress from school kids all over the country than any other issue except for the Vietnam War. And Congress passed that law, and they gave the horses 81 million acres. Now those horses are down to 26 million acres, which they call herd management areas.
And the reason for the diminishment of their land was probably somebody else wanted the land, correct?
That's correct. It's development. It's cattle ranchers who, at public taxpayer expense, get reduced grazing fees for public lands. It's mining interests. It's other development. It's hunting interests. It's recreational interests. There's a lot of people want that land.
Yeah.
But the American people, 80% of us, want to preserve and protect the wild horses. Our government isn't listening to us at all.
Yeah.
And because of that, I am concerned. And I've been thinking for many years, when I formed the Let 'Em Run Foundation with my partner, Carolyn Cardinale, which we formed it in 1998 or 99, but we never really got our charitable organization certificate from the we didn't bother to get that until 2004, I think we finally got it. But we've been doing it a long time. And the first thing she said to me, because she was in tourism, she said, the only way to save these wild horses is tourism. And I said, Carolyn, I believe you're right.
You know,
about 20 years ago, excuse me, go ahead.
Yep, I was just going to throw a quick insight in. Some time ago, I was interviewing a sheep rancher up in Montana. The subject was the reintroduction of wolves in the Yellowstone. And, of course, he was the subject of those wolves. But at any rate, the fish and game biologist responsible for reintroducing wolves came in the kitchen door, and he said, she's back. He had a tracking antenna in his hand. And he was saying that the she-wolf is back. So I offered him, please sit down and tell us exactly why you're reintroducing wolves in the Montana. And he said, I suggested, is it because you want to control the population of deer and elk? Is that what's going on? And he said, oh, no. The reason we're reintroducing wolves is because city people want them. And I puzzled over that. But you just reaffirmed that notion, too. City people love to see something left that's wild. And the horses
are...
Yeah.
We all do. We all have a need to connect. You know, there are people in this world, Michael, I know many of them, whose feet have never touched the earth. They've been raised in a ghetto or a barrio or a city, and they have never touched their feet have never touched the earth. They're on concrete and macadam and other things, but their feet never touch the earth, and they can't. I don't think it's healthy for people not to connect with the natural world. The natural world is the most beautiful and expressive part of the planet. A lot of people don't have any interest whatsoever in it because they've never been exposed to it. If they have, they've been bitten by mosquitoes or chased by a bull or whatever. And they have fear of it. But it's part of us. We're one with it. And the closer we are to it, the more natural people and the more loving people I think we are, because we realize the connection between us and all that is. Without that connection, people have become very, I think people are very angry now all over the world. People are, there are all this dissent, and there have been for thousands of years. I mean, this world is no child anymore, and we're not growing up very fast on this planet. We have not learned in thousands of years how to get along with each other, and we seem to love hate.
But the horses, the wild horses, seem to get along, don't they?
Well, they fight, too.
They fight, too.
They fight, too. Sure, they fight for territory. They fight for the stallions fight to have more mares to breed. You know, they're not so different from us.
Then it gets right down to it. Well, let me go back really quickly before we take a break and see if I can kind of paraphrase this. The government passed the Wild Free Roaming Horses and Burros Act of 1971 because it came to some kind of consensus that the wild horse population needed to be managed. It no longer had the natural predators, the wolves, the coyotes, the bears, were no longer eating them up. And so the populations were expanding. So how do we manage these horses, these wild horses? And so the law was passed that requires that so-called wild horses be managed as an integral part of a natural system of the public lands. And that was the entire system. And together, they were, the government was going to monitor herd size, establish sustainable target populations, which you just spoke about, and then remove excess animals. So that's quite a process, removing excess animals, because unlike how we manage wild populations of deer and elk and whatnot, we do not hunt wild horses. Why is that?
Because, first of all, people don't want it. 80% of the people in this country do not want wild horses to be killed for food. And that probably stems from memories of how valuable and how we could not have made it. Even we could not have even won the West without the horses. There's no possible way we could have done it on foot alone. No, these horses were our partners. They were our helpers. They helped us conquer everything we ever did as human beings. And they are different. They're a very special animal. A lot of people don't think so. There are a lot of people who believe, just like anything else, that they should be slaughtered. I believe that there's a win-win situation.
Oh boy, don't give it now because we have to take a break. So there is a win-win situation here, ladies and gentlemen.
So don't go anywhere.
Because we have Lacey J. Dalton, and she is the president, by golly, of Let 'Em Run. And therein might lie the solution. So please stay tuned. This is the Food Chain Radio program right back.
We're on the farm with Joel Salatin.
Would you like to buy homemade soup, backyard chicken, and the neighbor's artisanal lunch meat? The Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund protects your right to acquire the food of your choice from the source of your choice. I'm Joel Salatin from Polyface Farm, and I urge you to defend the right of neighbors to engage in direct food commerce. Join today at farmtoconsumer.org, the food of your choice from the source of your choice. That's farmtoconsumer.org, farmtoconsumer.org. Thank you.
When you buy local American-grown flowers, flowers will grow and flourish in America. Hello, I'm Deborah Prinzing, author of Slow Flowers for Certified American-Grown Flowers. When you buy local flowers, you're helping our country's family farms reduce the transportation footprint of flowers and enjoy fresher, longer-lasting bouquets. So please, next time you shop for flowers, think local. Think Certified American-Grown Flowers. Visit AmericanGrownFlowers.org to learn more.
Here's a little secret I'm telling you. Take a little pledge called the 2x2. Spend $2 on local food each day and get two friends to do the same and play. Oh, they'll spend their money, and when they're through, they'll get two friends and do it too. Do da do da 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 do 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 do. There's a little secret I shared with you, a simple pledge called the 2x2. You can do it. It don't cost much. It's so easy it'll make you blush. Pledge two local bucks each day. Get two others to pledge and play. Do-do-do-da-da-da-da-do-do-do. 2x2.
You can earn a substantial income by farming for the city. All you need to do is take your crop to market and win the competition for the consumer dollars. There is a well-proven strategy for winning this competition. You will find it embedded in MetroFarm, the guide to growing in or near the city for the city.
Herbal Connections, Maureen Rogers. I rate MetroFarm very high. All of the information is easy to understand and it reads really fast. You will get your money's worth out of MetroFarm. Egg economist, Dr. John Wyson.
Olson's Metro Farms enjoy competitive advantages which allow them to produce more crops per unit of higher quality at less cost than large-scale farms.
Before you plant your seeds, pick up a copy of the Ben Franklin Book of the Year award-winning Metro Farm. Then plant your seeds and win the dollars. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com.
They walk away from everything just to see a dream come true. So God bless the boys who make the noise on 16th Avenue.
Okay, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. That voice you heard, that beautiful, beautiful voice, was that of Lacey J. Dalton. And we're so happy to have had her join us today to talk about wild horses, of all things. A country western star talking about wild horses. There's just something that goes together with country western and horses.
Some people think that we're losing the whole culture and romance of the West, but I think with programs like Yellowstone and Bonanza in the past and Gunsmoke and the great cowboy poets and artists and cowboy singers and the great cowboy heroes of the silver screen will keep it alive probably forever.
Yes, because we want it, the wild, wild west, just like we want the wild animals, including the wild horses. Well, we do have the Bureau of Land Management, who has taken responsibility for managing wild horses. Some would say they're managing them to extinction, and that might be a good thing for a lot of people, but not for Lacey J. Dalton and 80% of the American people. And so how do we manage them? What do we do with the excess horses that are deemed excess by the Bureau of Land Management? What do we do with them now, Lacey?
Well, we have an enormous problem. It is an enormous problem. And it is, I believe, a problem that can be dealt with, but it's got to be dealt with very, very soon because it's already too much almost to deal with. There are 46,000 wild horses in long-term holding facilities, some of which are lovely and some of which are awful. And that's at the taxpayer's expense.
So wait a minute. So what we do with the excess animals is that we take them to holding pens and put them
for a while. Yeah, and there's a lot of pressure after 10 years to just simply to send them down to Mexico and send them to slaughter. And I have to say, the films that I've seen of the way those horses are slaughtered in Mexico is an abomination. It is an abomination before God, and I can't stand to think of it. I can't bear to think of it. However, there are a lot of people who are pushing for what is called the SAFE Act, which means that no horses can be sent out of the country to be slaughtered. Well, that's a very nice idea. But what do you do? That's not just wild horses. That's all kinds of horses, hundreds of thousands of horses who have no place to go. What do we do? It's a huge problem, and no one has been able to answer me about what happens if I don't want them to be sent to slaughter. Of course I don't. I don't think one horse should be sent to slaughter. I think some need to be euthanized because they're sick or they're old or they have injuries that can't be fixed. Of course we have to do that. But we now have birth control, and even the slow-moving boat of the Bureau of Land Management has even begun to do birth control with these wild horses. And there is compassionate, reversible birth control. I fear that the BLM, you can give this birth control for 5 or 6 years and then the horse can be allowed to have a baby. So you can control the size of the horses with that. But that's a huge undertaking because the horses have to be given the vaccine once a year. They're trying to do a five-year vaccine, and they'll probably get that done, and that's going to be a miracle and wonderful. There's a group up here on the Virginia range dealing with this largest, arguably largest herd of wild horses on private land. Not that doesn't count Indian reservations, because many of the Indian reservations, they just simply can't manage their herds. They don't have the money or the manpower to actually pull off.
I was just thinking, how many wild horses are there? There are 33,000 of them out running around. That would be a job to track them down and give them a shot.
It's a job to track any of them down and give them shots. But there's a group up here called American Wild Horse that is on the Virginia range, and they are doing a pilot program for this vaccine, which they're using one called, there are other vaccines, but they're using one called PZP that is reversible. And they are monitoring that and keeping good records of it. And it's a very important pilot project to see how this can happen. The other win-win situation is this. Imagine this. We almost had this about 20 years ago. We had this on a bill that was going to be funded, but it was tacked on the end of a bill for Afghanistan, and it got cut. The lettuce pork on the end of a bill, and it got cut. But we did have the support of senators and the Bureau of Land Management at that time. We're going to give us lands called the Pine Nut Horse Management Area, which is next to the Carson River, not far at all from Reno or the capital of Carson City, a very short drive, several thousand acres. This would have been where we would have practiced this birth control, and we would have had an interpretive center there, mm-hmm. which would show the history of the wild horse and how the horse has interacted with man over thousands of years, and would have become an incredible jewel of ecotourism for northern Nevada, where we have more horses than anywhere. So why not do it here? Unfortunately, that seed did not take root in Nevada. It's not a cheap project to undergo, but we did have the cooperation of the Bureau of Land Management. The master gardeners from the University of Nevada were going to plant native plants and do nature walks. There were going to be photographic safaris and horseback rides to interact with these animals in a non-invasive way, keep the numbers controlled by birth control, compassionate, in responsible birth control that can be reversed and must be reversed after 5 or 6 years, or the horses will become sterile. It's not the ideal situation, but if we don't do something, the Bureau of Land Management intends to round up 26,000 of the 33,000 wild horses left. Put those, in God knows where, in long-term holding at the expense of the taxpayers.
So they're like being put in prison until they die. In other words,
they're put in prison when they could be put in the like the wild animal mm-hmm. park in San Diego.
Now, the government like is the government is paying people to board these horses, right?
It just so, and it's my understanding that you, from a lot of those places, you are not allowed to go and see what's happening.
So wouldn't it make sense, instead of paying farmers to board all of these horses, to build a facility like you're talking about and put them in there and then let them run around?
Put them in there and put a couple on one side or the other of Yellowstone Park, one in Texas done in a vaquero mode, and make ecotourism with these wild horses. You have no idea how many people from all over the world would flock to see. Yellowstone Park has 33 million visitors a year. People would certainly go to see the Wild Horse Park if it were close by. And we've written to Wyoming and Montana, to the legislatures, and they've got no reply because mm-hmm. they hate the wild horses out there. But it's just like, in Virginia City, when the miners were looking for gold up in Virginia City, and this is a little anecdote that I think will prove a point. And there was this icky, gunky, bluish, gray clay that was clogging up all their panning and their equipment, and miners just hated it. And there were piles of this gunk all over Virginia City. And then someone realized that this was silver ore. This mud, this gunk, was silver. And the largest silver strike in the history of mining happened in Virginia City, the Comstock Lode. I feel like these wild horses are our new Comstock Lode. We're overlooking them. We are looking at them as though they are a waste and a problem and a challenge and need to be eliminated, when in fact they can be worth their weight in gold. Because don't tell me that people wouldn't pay 12 or 13 bucks to go into a place and interact. People love these horses. They have spoken. The American people made their will perfectly clear in 1971, and I'll bet you they would do it again today. If we had that same sort of letter-writing campaign to Congress, you know, I think that people, most people, when you talk to them, say, well, yeah, we want to preserve them for our children and our children's children. Yes, we want to preserve this incredible icon of the American West. Yes, we want to do this. Can you imagine doing one on an Indian reservation? Say Standing Rock, which has tons and tons, the Lakota Reservation in North Dakota, tons of land. Imagine how that would help the Indian people up there and bring people to their beautiful casino. You know, mom and dad could play in the casino, and grandpa and grandma could take kids out to visit the wild horses and watch the Indian way of managing horses.
Well, you know, that's
the way they were good at it.
You, Lacey, you have an incredible vision, and yet it was turned down. Who turned it down, and why did they turn it down? What was the reason that?
Well, because it was on a, it was pork on the end of a bill for Afghanistan. It had no business being there.
So they didn't turn it down.
Well, they didn't really turn it down, but we couldn't get funding for it. And BLM, you know, lost interest because of that. And it would be a whole nother thing. I think it would take some powerful organization probably to make a proper presentation and do a study to see just exactly how much money could be made. I think it could be millions and millions and millions of dollars could be made to preserve and protect these horses and to allow people to see them in their national. Look what I'd love to know. In fact, I need to look up how many visitors there are to the Wild Animal Park in San Diego. That's not losing money. You know, when people go down there to see these animals in a natural habitat, and I've been there, and it's fabulous.
Lacey J. Dalton, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Michael.
All right.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.